episode 52 of the DFA podcast. I'm your host, Brian Grosnick, and joining me, my co-host, RJ Anderson. RJ, we got stuff to talk about today.
Yes, you know it's a big deal when we have, what, three moves to talk about? Four?
Not just three moves, but three moves that are a tier or two above the Jeff Manship or the Adam Rosales tier, as we call our minor moves that come in sometimes. We got some real high profile free agents signing with new teams. We've got one team which is, well, the less said about them, the better, perhaps, but we'll get into that later in the show. But we got to start off with our big stuff. We got big, big news today, finally, for a change. It's been a long time coming.
It has been.
So, well, I think the first thing we should talk about is the first one that happened chronologically. We've got two big free agent signings, top tier free agent signings, top five maybe free agent signings. But we'll start with the first one, which is Eric Hosmer signing an 8-year, $144 million contract with the San Diego Padres. Hosmer is moving from Kansas City to San Diego. Let's get some quick thoughts from you on this, because there are strong opinions on this deal online. I have a little bit of a more nuanced take on it, but I want to hear what you think about the Padres going out and buying themselves a first baseman of Hosmer's caliber.
I mean, there are never strong opinions online, Brian, so I'm not sure I believe that. And I thought that your transaction analysis on the move was probably the best thing I read about the deal. I don't know. It's an interesting deal because, you know, from my perspective, I've been skeptical of Hosmer's breakout season. At the same time, I have nothing against the guy getting paid, and I like the Padres going out and being aggressive. You know, you can argue that maybe whatever upgrade Hosmer gives them is kind of washed by Will Myers moving back to the outfield. And as someone who had the, let's call it, pleasure of watching Will Myers in the outfield before, he is going to drive Padres fans batty because he's actually pretty good athletically. You know, he could run well and all that, but for whatever reason, he was really never able to pick up on the nuances of playing outfield or the nuances of many things. What about you? Do you have any straw? I know you, again, I read your TA, so I kind of know what you're going to say here, I think, but what are your thoughts here generally?
So the simple answer to this is I like the Padres spending money. I like the Padres spending money on a younger, productive player, going out and being aggressive in free agency. I have questions about the particular player that they chose, more because of his position and the team's existing strengths, rather than I am like, oh, Eric Hosmer's not a good enough player to get a contract like this. Exactly what you said. The Padres already had a first baseman who is a more powerful hitter than Eric Hosmer, and now they're going to shift him to maybe left field, maybe right field, where, yes, he will be an upgrade over, I don't know, Corey Spangenberg or Travis Jankowski or maybe even Hunter Renfro. But this is a team that's getting what might be a marginal upgrade by bringing in Hosmer as opposed to bringing in Lorenzo Cain or perhaps bringing in somebody else who is a different free agent. Now, I think the idea behind the Padres bringing in Hosmer is that they see Hosmer as a superstar-level talent, whereas other teams or other analysts may not. That is where the kind of the rubber meets the road on the online discussion, because a lot of people think that Eric Hosmer is not anywhere near an all-star caliber player. He's more of a 2-3 win player because his defense may be good, but may not be. We don't really know. He's got 4 gold gloves, but the metrics aren't very nice to him. He's not a super power hitting first baseman. He hits for great average, but he's not a real true power hitting first baseman. So there's a lot of things about his profile that make people say, maybe this guy isn't really deserving or worthy of the kind of contract that he's getting, and the Padres kind of stacking first baseman on top of each other is a weird fit for the team.
Yeah, and I will note that he has a weird Brett Saberhagen like thing going on. If you look at BP's warp totals, he's been worth 3.7, 1.4, 3.4, 0.6, and then 3.6. So there's a lot of inconsistency built in there. Mm-hmm. And if you get deeper into these things, you know, last season has been billed as a breakout year for him, homer 25 times, almost had a 500 slugging percentage for the first time in his career, best offensive campaign of his career. You say, oh, he bought into the fly ball revolution or whatever you want to call it. He did not, because he hit basically as many ground balls as usual. He pulled the ball less often than normal, and his average exit velocity actually went down like 2 full miles per hour. So, you know, again, if you're getting under the hood to that extent, there's really nothing in there suggesting that he changed as a hitter or, you know, bought into any of these, let's call them telltale signs of learning to tap into his power or making the most of his raw hitting ability. But I like what you mentioned in your TA about his bat to ball skills. And I think that sort of underrated nowadays. I know people, you know, for the most part, we don't talk about batting average ever. It's always about, you know, exit velocity nowadays and whatnot. And yeah, sure, I'm skeptical about the idea of a first baseman who's nearing age 30 relying so much on ground balls. But I do think there's a lot to be said about being able to put the bat on the ball, excuse me. And he's consistently hit for a high average. So at this point, I don't know that I'm willing to accept that he's likely to crater in the next, say, 3-4 years. Now down the road, that could be a different story. But I guess for the most part, I am fine with this deal. I thought he would actually get more money. And again, I like to see the Padres be aggressive. And I don't know about the Will Myers move, but at the same time, you know, maybe this is the beginning of the Padres being a relative force in the free agent market, because the way the deal is structured is pretty interesting. So I don't know. We'll see. But I guess I just don't hate it as much as I thought I would entering the offseason.
Yeah, I think part of that has to do a little bit with the average annual value of this deal. You know, $144 million over 8 years is very different than what it sounded like his camp was looking for at the onset of the offseason, which was something like, you know, 8 years and $180 million or 8 years and $200 million. We're talking about a substantial drop in what maybe the expectation for the value of this deal was going to be. And there's another thing to this, which is the player opt-out. So he's got a relatively front-loaded contract with an opt-out after 5 seasons. And those last 3 seasons on the deal are like, I don't know, $40 million. So it's kind of another one of these contracts where the payments seem to be in line with the expected production for a long-term free agent contract. You expect these guys to be more valuable in the front half or the front years of these long free agent contracts. And now, you know, yes, it's an 8-year deal, and yes, he's got the opportunity to opt out, but when it comes down to the time where he should be, quote, a drag on the payroll, when, you know, the curve of his career is, you know, he's expected to be not as good of a hitter or a player or anything, they're paying him considerably less. You know, $13 million in, I don't know, 2023 doesn't sound like a lot of money, although the way the free agent market's going this offseason, maybe we're going to see even more of a collapse going forward in player salaries, which would be terrible. But I do think that makes the contract more interesting. I do think there's some pressure on him to be a top-tier offensive player. And you mentioned that there weren't any signs that he's bought into the flyball revolution. He is well-positioned that if the adjustments can be made, and if he wants to make those adjustments, he's got a lot of the same skill set as Daniel Murphy had, where high-level bat-to-ball ability, really, you know, kind of a cerebral, a guy who is able to make adjustments as a hitter. But also, I mean, ever since he came out of high school, he's had, like, legit raw power. And it's kind of surprising he wasn't able to access it, though, you know, playing in Kansas City doesn't help. I don't think that's going to change much in San Diego because, you know, the ballpark is also a bit of a pitcher's park, even though it's less of one than it used to be. But, you know, you've got the possibility that he could still have another gear that he could take it to.
Yeah, and obviously there's some risk there signing a guy to this deal and then asking him to fundamentally change his approach and whatnot.
Yeah, sure.
At the same time, though, yeah, it's certainly possible that, you know, maybe he has one of those Adrian Gonzalez in his prime seasons somewhere down the road. I don't think it's likely, but I mean, at the same time, you know, he's homered 50 times over the last 2 seasons. That's not nothing. It's just, you know, the rest of the profile power-wise just wasn't there to result in a high slugging or anything like that. I don't know. Like I said, I think I hate it less than I anticipated during the winter, and I'm glad that he got paid. I have nothing against the guy getting paid. And, you know, there's also the aspect that we're not really talking about here, because I don't think either one of us has a great deal of insight there, but the makeup, the intangibles, the chemistry, whatever you want to call it, you know, this guy has gotten praise nonstop for his role in the Kansas City clubhouse. I have no idea how much that adds, if it's even legitimate, but those inside the game seem to believe it. And if Hosmer does add something on that extent, you know, that should be credited to him, even if we can't quantify it. Maybe a couple runs, maybe, I don't know, maybe it's really more than that. I don't know. But if you're a Padres player, a Padres fan, I think you have to, again, be pleased that they're trying, they're doing something here instead of just, you know, proceeding with a bare bones roster and bare bones budget that would probably not be expected to compete until 2019 at the earliest. So maybe this is one of those flag planting signings that shows that the Padres and their new front office are serious about winning again after, you know, a couple of seasons of, I mean, this time last year, we were talking about Christian Bethencourt.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
Two of Rule 5 picks. So you know what? This is a huge step forward. So kudos to them for that, even if you don't necessarily believe Hosmer is a star or a superstar level player.
Yeah, the one thing I'll throw out there, you make a great point about the intangibles. The Padres had the top organizational prospect ranking that we did at Baseball Prospectus. They have an extraordinary depth of young talent that's about ready to come up to the majors or is a little bit further away. They've even got a couple of really strong, good players, young players on the major league roster, and guys like Manny Margot. It's very rare that you're able to get a guy in free agency who's still relatively young, who has that great reputation as a clubhouse leader, and who has experience, you know, going to two and winning one World Series. I think that whether or not it actually makes too much of a difference on the field, it is probably a net positive for an example for other kids in the clubhouse, an example for, you know, winning culture. This is what a winner looks like. And I got to be honest, the Padres have not had that in a very long time in their clubhouse. They have been relatively inexpensive, you know, signing inexpensive guys in the free agent market. When they make trades for players, it's usually not to bring in, you know, high talent, it's more high upside guys than guys who have been proven performers. So Hosmer is kind of a sea change in that regard. So I agree with you completely. I don't know if it'll show up on the field. I don't know if it'll show up in player development, but you can certainly understand why the front office might make a move like this.
Yeah. And I will say that team is, I don't want to know if they're totally fun, but of course we did a whole show devoted to them last September. Right. So I think they're funner than the average bear. And I'll say that, you know, Hosmer, Myers, Margot, there's something brewing there in that lineup. If you add in a few of the other parts they have, Chase Headley's there. I mean, they're not going to compete for a playoff spot, but again, this is way better than what they looked like entering last season. So I don't know. I'm finding it hard to really dock this signing or, you know, get mad about it or anything because, again, there's just a lot to like here, even for reasons beyond his play on the field.
Yeah. Yep, I agree with you completely. Although I do think most people on the internet would disagree with you. It seems like, generally speaking, there's a lot of vitriol towards the Padres for making this deal, thinking that it's an overpay for a player who the analytics say is perhaps not at the level that he should be at, or for strange roster construction. That's not worth all that much, you know, a big online hubbub about this, but you know, I would think if I were a Padres fan, I would see this as a unabashed positive. You know, it's not like the Padres have, this was the final move for the Padres. It's not like they did this and got to the upper echelon of their payroll. This is not like the move that they, you know, we're going to commit this money to Eric Hosmer and this is all the money we've got left ever. So I think that's worth thinking about. Now, I would like to switch gears and talk about what may be a final move for a team, the other big free agent signing that we've got on our agenda for today, and that's JD Martinez. JD Martinez, after months of kind of dancing around it and will he, won't he, it's very much like a romantic comedy, has finally made his match with the Boston Red Sox. It's going to be a 5-year, $110 million contract, but he is apparently going to Boston. This is really interesting to me, but I want to hear your thoughts on it first.
I mean, it's a no-brainer if you're Boston, right?
Yes and no. The thing is, Boston has three really good outfielders, and now they've went and bought a fourth. But yes, yeah, I do think it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, I mean, Martinez, if you look at the last 3 years of production, he's right there with Giancarlo Stanton in terms of OPS plus, home runs, all that good stuff. Now, granted, Martinez is older, significantly worse fielder to the point where it's probably what a potentially a 25 to 30 run difference in defense. But, they're bringing Martinez in here because of his bat, and presumably he's going to be slotted in at DH, which kind of gets him off the hook for Hanley Ramirez's vesting option. It allows them to platoon Mitch Moreland and Hanley at first, if that's something they so desire to do. And this was the team that ranked last in the American League in isolated slugging last year. Well, you just went out there and added one of the top sluggers in baseball to a contract that, frankly, I thought could have had a fair amount more money on and I would have been okay with. I mean, again, I thought entering the season, we did a free agent draft at CBS, and Martinez was my top pick, and he was the first overall pick to me because I believe in the bat. And, the defense, I think sometimes, I don't know, maybe positioning can help him, maybe not. I know he's not great out there no matter what, but he can really, really, really hit, and that's still important. I mean, that's very important. That's what gets you to the majors, and that's what keeps you to the majors. And he's only 30. I mean, he won't turn 31 until the middle of the season. I don't know. I probably am higher on Martinez than most people because I just see a well-rounded hitter who I'm not expecting to drop off a cliff in the next 3 to 4 years. He has an opt-out after the 2019 season as well as the 2020 season. I don't think he'll be opting out after 2020 because that's when a guy named Mike Trout is around and he'll be a free agent. It's sort of similar to the Hosmer deal in that we're kind of expecting him to opt out early on, or not early on in this case because it's 2 years versus, 5 years for Hosmer, but we're still expecting him to opt out before all the money is paid. And I think that's a very interesting sea change. It seems like it's become way more common these past few winters than it ever was 10, 15 years ago. And I just know that it's kind of funny looking at this Boston lineup because you have what should be a pretty good and exciting team. You mentioned the outfield. You have Betts and Benintendi, Bogarts, and you can keep listing off talent. You look at the rotation. You have Sale Price. You have a recent Cy Young winner in there. You have Pomerantz, who's shown flashes. You have one of the best closers in baseball, and Craig Kimbrell. And yet nobody's really excited about this team because of injuries and also because it just feels like they're going to underachieve again, and it's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I do think it's kind of crazy because I really think that you mentioned early on that the Red Sox had the lowest isolated slugging in baseball last year. They didn't hit for any power. It was a big complaint, and it was a legitimate problem with this franchise. I do not see with any level of like moderate regression that even without signing JD Martinez, this team was going to be last in ISO in 2018. There was no chance of that. Benintendi and Betts, Jackie Bradley, Rafael Devers, these are all guys who can hit for some power. And I had no assumptions going into this next season that they would have such a power outage. I think that was kind of a combination of bad luck and a little bit of how the team was constructed to be a little bit more about, getting on base than hitting for power. So that didn't bother me. I'm going to go out on a limb here. I think the addition of JD Martinez to the Red Sox makes the Red Sox a co-favorite for the American League East with the Yankees. I think they're right neck and neck at this point. And I think that bringing him in as a designated hitter is about the best thing for him, and it's about the best thing for any team that employs him. This is kind of the reason why I'm glad that the Red Sox got him instead of the Diamondbacks, because now I think we have the opportunity to just see JD Martinez for the hitter, and we don't have to take into account the fact that he's so bad defensively. I've seen him play defense. I've watched him out in right field. It's not good. We don't want him to play there. And with this signing, the Red Sox have basically gotten somebody who's very similar to David Ortiz in terms of overall offensive production. He's not quite the same hitter Ortiz is, especially over time, but he's the closest thing to it that the Red Sox have had since Ortiz retired, which hasn't been that long. Plus, he can back up a little bit if one of the guys in the outfield needs to take a breather or something. But his acquisition, I think, is perfect for this team. It gives them power. It gives them a cleanup hitter who will slot in very nicely, be able to drive in Betts and Benintendi, and give a little bit of pressure off Rafael Devers, who was kind of going to be looked at as being the big run producer for this team going forward. I think it's a great move. I think that the amount of money that he's getting paid is borderline criminal. Though I do think the opt-out is going to come into play for Martinez, and I don't necessarily think it was really going to come into play for Hosmer. Martinez is expected to not have much of a performance dropout or drop-off over the next 2 seasons. So if he is going into his age, like 33 season, coming off 2 solid seasons in Boston, it would not surprise me at all for him to opt out of what, just $60 million over 3 years and try to get something, even if it's just a repeat of this contract, get 5 and 100 again. So that really wouldn't surprise me at all. I think this may be more of a 2-year deal than a 5-year deal.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I don't disagree with the idea that the Red Sox are right there, the Yankees. Actually, this is as good a time as any to bring up my favorite little fun fact that I found about the Red Sox this week. And it concerns David Price because the perception is that David Price has been a huge disappointment in Boston. And I realize that, health plays into that. But let me just throw this number out at you because it really surprised me. Price with Tampa Bay had a 1.22 career ERA plus, a 3.45 strikeout to walk ratio, 3.33 FIP. And, for the old school listeners out there, he won roughly 64% of the games he pitched in. One loss record's meaningless, blah, blah. Just throwing it out there. With Boston, and again, this is a smaller sample and he missed a lot of time with injury. He has a 1.17 ERA plus, a 4.11 strikeout to walk ratio, 3.61 FIP, and he's won 66% of the game decisions, I should say. I mean, I guess if I had just blindly wrote down how much I thought his performance would be separated from his Tampa Bay days when he was considered an ace, it would have been a lot larger than this the fairly minor difference in ERA plus, and I mean, he has a better strikeout to walk ratio. I know he's been more prone to the long ball, but if Price is healthy, I think he's still a very good pitcher, and it wouldn't surprise me if Sale and Price goes out there and kind of lives up to the hype this season. And if they do, the non-Yankee American League East teams are in a lot of trouble. I mean, we're going to talk about one of those teams in a few minutes, but can't you just see Chris Sale and David Price throwing a 3-game series against the Rays and just combining for like 25 strikeouts over like 16 innings or something absurd like that? Because I feel like I can see that happening. And again, they have a guy who won the Cy Young Award the season before last, and we don't even talk about him.
Well, I mean, that's fair though. We probably shouldn't.
Yes.
Rick Porcello is not really a he's a great middle of the rotation number four hand, but he is not the lead here. We have to talk about the lefties. It's Sale and Price. I do think that there is one unfortunate side to the Martinez signing for the Red Sox, and it's this. The first base platoon for the Red Sox now is going to be Hanley Ramirez and Mitch Moreland. And I'm not sure there is a worse position for any team in baseball when it comes to expected performance versus what the contracts are for those particular players. This Mitch Moreland contract, I was not a fan of the Red Sox signing him for 2 years earlier in this offseason. But to me, this looks like if they could go back in time and undo that contract, boy, I bet they wish they could. Because if Hanley is going to be your starting first baseman for at least, maybe like half the time, I know he might be the short side of that platoon, which is kind of crazy to think about. But I mean, I just can't imagine that they wish that they could spend $14 million and not have that money back. I mean, they've got Sam Travis, they've got other players that they could throw in as like kind of that left-handed, platoon option at first base. We just talked about Eduardo Nunez. And so they brought in Eduardo Nunez to be kind of like the super sub, and he could have been the right side of a platoon at first base. Now it doesn't really matter too much because, Hanley's there and Hanley hits right-handed, but they have so many other options at first base now. I really feel like that move in hindsight really kind of sucks for the Red Sox.
Yeah, they had external options they could have turned to too. I mean, they could have potentially gotten Logan Morrison or Lucas Duda or a number of other left-handed first basemen for presumably less than that. Maybe not, because maybe that's why those guys are still available. But You're right. I think in retrospect, that looks like a questionable decision. And I don't know. I don't really know that I've understood the Mitch Moreland hype or any of that. He had a good season a few years ago, and since then, it seems like the ideal Mitch Moreland season is basically being unnoticeable, like being a league average guy who, depending on your perspective, is either a good glove or perhaps an overrated glove. But you're talking about like what a win season? That's basically a good Mitch Moreland year, and to lock him into a multi-year deal as he's nearing, I believe this is going to be his age 32 season is, yeah. I mean, at least the Red Sox, so it's not like his contract is going to prevent them from doing anything. It's just sort of weird in retrospect, you're right.
Yeah, I do think it's weird, but I do think this makes it more exciting in the American League. Makes it more exciting for me personally now, because I live in New England and now I get to hear about the Red Sox a lot more because the Red Sox have made these big moves with Nunez and with Moreland and with Martinez. But yeah, who you got in the American League East this year? Are you going Yankees or are you going Red Sox?
Man, you're gonna put me on the spot here.
Yep.
Like I said, I would not be surprised whatsoever if Price stays healthy and they just have that dominant 1-2 punch. But I'd probably go Yankees because I'm very conservative about pitcher health, and I guess if I'm prefacing this decision by saying I'm very conservative about pitcher health, I should probably not be picking the Yankees considering
Right,
they
I was
have
going to
not
say.
been great. I want to say Yankees because I feel like, man, I'm gonna. This is horrible because I feel like I have to stick with whoever I pick now. Yeah, I'll go Yankees, but I don't think it's gonna be a runaway or anything. Like you said, I think it's gonna be close, and if Boston wins, it won't surprise me because I could
Yeah.
see a path to them being very, very, very good. And I actually just had a front office guy last maybe 2, 3 weeks ago now tell me that he thought Boston was the most overlooked potential dynasty in baseball because of the young talent we talked about. Because they have Sale, they have Price, they have the potential to add more. Everybody talks about the Yankees in that division. I would almost say that people were at this point perhaps more excited about Toronto's future as well with some of the prospects they
Oof.
have coming. And Boston feels like it's kind of in that third or fourth slot, depending on how hype people are about Willy Adames and company in terms of the next 5 years, next 10 years, or whatever. So yeah, I do agree with that sentiment as well that this could be, a very, very, very good baseball team for a long time, and Martinez should help them achieve that in the near term.
Yeah, I'm going to go the other side. I think the Red Sox are my favorite for the American League East this year. I think the Yankees have a better collection of young talent. I'm not sure everything comes together the way that it needs to this year. I mean, the Yankees, they still have a hole at third base, which maybe is going to be filled by Miguel Andujar, maybe it's going to be filled by Gleyber Torres, maybe it's going to be filled by, I don't know, Mike Moustakas. Who knows at this point? But I do think I would rely more on the Red Sox rotation, given all the question marks that are there, over the Yankees rotation, given all the question marks that are there. So I would slightly lean Red Sox at this point. Hopefully that's not a New England bias showing there, but I would slightly lean Red Sox. I do think, though, that if the Red Sox did not make a move like this for this year, for next year, for the near-term future, I think once you get into next year and beyond, the Yankees are going to start running away with this because the Red Sox young talent's very good. These guys like Benintendi and Betts and Bogarts and Devers. But they're also going to start to get expensive. I mean, Jackie Bradley Jr. is making a lot of money this year. Betts is making a lot of money. These guys who are arbitration guys, Sale and Price will make a lot of money forever. Ostensibly, you've got a lot of money being wrapped up in some of these different guys where it's funny to think about it, but the Yankees probably have a lot more payroll flexibility coming up in the next couple of years because their good young players are going to be cheaper longer, with the exception of Giancarlo Stanton. So I just think it's going to be really interesting to see this interplay back and forth. As gross as it is, I do kind of think baseball is more interesting when the Yankees and the Red Sox are like these big, heavy duty teams fighting it out on the top of the American League East because it makes it that much sweeter when the Blue Jays or the Orioles or the Rays pops up through the cracks and David's to the Goliath for a little bit.
Easy content cannot be overvalued, Brian. I will say, here's a segue for you. You talked about your New England bias. Well, I'm from the Tampa area, which is,
Right.
as everyone knows, home of the Yankees. So, they're the only big league club in town, right? There's no other
No,
baseball teams in that area.
there is not another baseball team in Tampa because Tampa is making moves to get rid of all of their players who make substantial money and or mostly effective. That does segue nicely into our next segment where we were going to talk about the recent moves that the Tampa Bay Rays have made. First things first, the Rays traded Jake Odorizzi to the Twins in a move that you have been calling for, or at least calling that is going to happen for the past month, maybe 2 months, maybe 3 months on the show. You have been talking about Jake Odorizzi going to another team, probably in the Midwest. There was a lot of talk about him going to the Brewers or another franchise, but he's ending up going to the Twins. In return, I believe it's Jorge Palacios that's coming back to Tampa Bay, which is fine. He's not what one might consider a top prospect.
Let's be honest. You had no idea who the dude was before the trade happened because nobody did.
Well,
When.
he's the fourth best shortstop prospect in the Minnesota Twins organization.
Right. He
So.
was the 31st best prospect in their system. And when Jeff Passan reported that it was part of a package, it was like, all right, maybe they'll get, someone we've heard of. And then it turned out that the package was really just him. And it's like, holy smokes. What? What kind of. I
I could
mean,
have
okay.
seen this being Wander Javier for Jake Odorizzi or somebody who's a little bit higher level. So before we get too far into that, I do want to pair it up with a couple of other moves. They traded, I believe it's nothing or cash considerations to the Angels to get CJ Cron into ostensibly, I don't know, do what CJ Cron does, which is hit sometimes and not really play the field. And then the third move, which is probably the biggest red flag or the biggest warning sign or the biggest strange move, is that they have designated for assignment 2017 All-Star Corey Dickerson, meaning that they have 10 days to trade or release him. So there it is in the aggregate. On to you, RJ. Tell us about the Rays.
So I think we can start with the Crone acquisition because that's the most straightforward and easiest to talk about. He is what he is. I mean, if you know CJ Crone, you know what he is, and that's a hacker who is pretty one-dimensional at the plate. He's going to hit for power, not necessarily an elite amount of power, never has had a 200 ISO or better, but he's going to give you some power, and that's about it because he doesn't walk. He strikes out quite a bit, hits a lot of pop-ups, doesn't really play good defense. Yeah, I mean, that's the long and short of it. He's
He's
from that
an
Mark Trumbo, Ryan Healy family. Oh, except he has reverse splits, which who knows if that's going to stick.
average hitter. Like his true average by baseball prospectus every year except 2016 has been right around that average mark, right around 260. He's 268 for his career, and he's a first baseman at best, more comfortably a designated hitter.
But in Tampa Bay, being a league average hitter makes you like the second or third best hitter on the team.
That's
So I will
correct.
say, I don't have a big issue acquiring Crone and putting him at first base because the alternative was Brad Miller. And I mean, that's a huge, frankly, Crone might be a better fielder than Miller, even at first base. So they might have upgraded at the dish and in the field at first base by acquiring Crone. I have no issue with that, do you? For the
No.
price, that's nothing. So yeah, I mean,
No.
whatever.
The only thing is that I thought that the Rays had a pretty decent DH, option in Corey Dickerson.
Yeah, let's talk about that part of it. So here's the thing. Like, the problem with the Crone acquisition is that in return, they designated Dickerson for assignment. And this came an hour before they announced that Odorizzi had been traded for a non-40-man roster player. So they didn't need to do the Dickerson DFA. They didn't need to do it at all to clear a roster spot or anything like that. And they didn't need to do it even if they did, because have you seen their 40-man roster?
It's
There are
not good.
some. Right, there are some dudes there who can be, and I am so over the Dickerson stuff. I mean, the explanation is, coming from the Rays GM Eric Neander's mouth, is that they wanted to have basically a hard deadline on moving Dickerson. And then you read Mark Topkin's piece in the Tampa Bay Times where it's suggested that internally the Rays are okay releasing Dickerson and paying him like $1 million termination fee because Crone has an extra year of service time, so they feel they came out ahead. Here's the problem. That's stupid.
Yeah,
One thing,
that's.
you can set an internal deadline. You knew camp was opening. You knew the season was getting close. Have an internal deadline on when you want to move Dickerson. For another thing, paying this dude money to go away so you can have one additional season of an inferior player who, in all likelihood, is not going to be on your roster for 2 or 3 seasons because, good Lord, if he is, you're probably doing something very wrong. That's ridiculous. And there's been a lot of talk about Corey Dickerson's second half, and it's driving me crazy. Like, I read this thing yesterday where someone was defending the move because Dickerson was bad in the second half last season, and CJ Krohn was good for the second half. And when you stack up their numbers, Corey Dickerson has a career 119 OPS plus and more than 2,000 plate appearances. The lowest he's been is 106 since his rookie season. This dude can hit. Yes, he's a free swinger. Yes, he swings outside of the strike zone way too much for my comfort. At the same time, he is an above average hitter. He's proven to be an above average hitter. And while he plays defense like he has a crush on the ball and he's kind of tentative, the defensive metrics say he's not as bad as he looks sometimes. So you're talking about a guy who can bat fourth, fifth, sixth against right-handed pitchers. Although I will note he was actually pretty good against lefties last season. He can also play a passable corner outfield. You probably put him on left and hide him there, but he's in his prime. He has 2 years of team control remaining, and you're willing to just give this dude away? I do not understand this at all. And I would just say, under Andrew Friedman, this team succeeded because they were so good at asset management. They were really good at working the margins. They were really good at pouncing on opportunities to acquire other teams' mistakes, like when other teams, for whatever reason, didn't value a Corey Dickerson well enough and designated him for assignment, therefore losing all their leverage in trades. This front office is not good at roster management. They're not good at asset management. They're horrible at that stuff. And they're also, when you listen to behind-the-scenes stuff, bad at communication, bad at basically everything you can be bad at. And you look at the news yesterday, Chris Archer speaking out against this front office moves, Kevin Kiermaier, Evan Longoria, Matt Andrees is mad because they moved him to the bullpen without warning. This Rays franchise has, I believe it's the largest baseball operations staff in the entire league, and this is the best y'all can do? That's horrible. Like, what are y'all even doing? This is the best you can do. What happened to the pride in Tampa Bay? What happened to the creativity? Y'all have no pride and y'all have no creativity anymore. You've given in to the nihilistic leanings that are just horrible. It's horrible for that fan base.
I mean, there is an argument that this is an extremely creative move. I mean,
Oh.
it is extremely creative to just give away your best hitter, coming into the new season and be like, maybe the new market inefficiency is giving away our best player because he makes $6.5 million this year. That's, now we're really thinking outside the box. The Dickerson thing is crazy because you talked about the flaws in Corey Dickerson's game. He swings at the ball outside of the strike zone too much. He hits for power, but he's not a great fielder. This is literally the same problems that anyone would have with CJ Krohn as a player,
Yes.
except for the fact that Dickerson is better.
And
Dickerson
he can
was
play the outfield.
right. Dickerson was a 4-win player last year. CJ Krohn was a half-win player last year. Because when we talk about CJ Krohn, well, he doesn't quite hit for, he hits for power, but not enough. Corey Dickerson hits for enough power. He's fine. He hit 50 home runs over the last 2 years. CJ Krohn hit like 30 and change. There is a huge, like, there's just a mental discrepancy, I think, here between valuation of these players. And it may simply come down to the fact that the front office is lying and that the team has to cut payroll, whether that's from a front office perspective or it's from an ownership perspective. Because
Oh, we
they're.
know who it'd be from. We know it'd be ownership. Come on. I mean, honestly, do you think the front office is going to be like, we're going to cut payroll unless the owners were rattling the sabers, so to speak?
Absolutely not. But what I want to say is, like, there are other teams that this happens with, where they say, well, oh, we made this deal for baseball reasons, but we know it's really for payroll reasons. The Mets do that all the time. The Athletics never openly say, very rarely openly say, like, nope, we had to move away from this guy because we can't afford him. It's always couched in, well, it's a baseball decision terms, because it has to be. The Rays, we talk about Corey Dickerson and getting rid of him like it's crazy. The Rays have other options. Jake Bowers is the left-handed hitter who's going to be a bad defensive left fielder, just like Corey Dickerson, and they got to give him a shot at some point. So there's this sense that the team has other ready-made options. The point here, though, is you are giving Corey Dickerson away. If you could not make a deal to get a reasonable return back for him, which kind of makes sense, the left field hitter market is a little bit saturated. If former Ray Logan Morrison doesn't have a job, the teams that might want him might be the same types of teams that want Corey Dickerson, or more accurately, don't want Corey Dickerson. You still don't DFA him 10 days, give yourself 10 days, which the clock's ticking on this, when you're obviously willing to trade somebody of, I wouldn't say the same value, because I think Jake Odorizzi has a very different kind of value, but they're paid relatively the same. They're both assets that can help a team. And you're willing to trade Odorizzi for what I would consider a C, C-plus prospect. Either you're not even getting that much in return for Dickerson at this point, or you're, that's the, you're getting worse offers than that for Dickerson, then you keep the asset and you wait until the deadline, or you wait until May. The JD Martinez blows out his knee for the Red Sox. Guess what? They'll take $6 million or $4 million, whatever's left on Corey Dickerson's contract, to replace him. Like, there are teams that will do things. Don't artificially limit your options just so that you can trade for CJ Krohn.
Yeah, and I have 2 points before we move on to Odorizzi that expand upon that. For one thing, you talk about them having options. Because they're going to play the Super 2 game of all these guys, though, they're actually not going to have those options for at least a month or plus into the season. And right now, if you look at their projected lineup, you know who they made move, excuse me, you know who they made room for here? Malik Smith. And look, we've seen with Jared Dyson, we've seen with Sam Fuld that speed and D can keep you around the league for a few years. Malik Smith is not going to hit enough to start. He's just not. I mean, if you watch the guy, you know he's not going to hit enough to start. They also have Denard Span now slotted in as their DH. If, again, if you trust the route, you know who is a better left-handed hitter than Denard Span, who could probably DH and put up more value?
I do.
Corey Dickerson.
I do.
Yeah. And their bench is horrible. It's Jesus Sucre, which catcher, so you're not gonna replace him. Ryan Schimpf, a left-handed bat who is known for his power and
Poor command of the
here.
strike zone.
Right. I was trying to think of a nice way to say that. Joey Wendell, who, good Lord, come on. And Daniel Robertson, who has to be the backup shortstop and who's probably going to see some time in the outfield because they don't have another right-handed bat right
Yeah.
now. And that's what they need to do. They need a couple right-handed bats. But the other point I wanted to make is just what are you doing? I mean, come on. Gosh, this is so annoying to me. And, if they really needed to cut costs, Brad Miller and Adeeni Echevarria, excuse me, I butchered Echevarria's name right there. Adeeni Echevarria both got tendered contracts. Neither of them is all that good. They're paying Echevarria $6 million. They knew they had Willy Adames coming at some point, which, by the way, the fact that they are paying Echevarria $6 million tells me Adames is not coming up anytime soon. They are definitely going to Ahmed Rosario him, it seems like.
Oh,
Or
sure.
right. So if you're willing to eat costs, why don't you terminate Echevarria and Miller, save money that way, and keep Dickerson and keep the better player until, like you said, you get a good offer for him. You have anything else you want to add on that before we move to Odorizzi real quick?
The Rays value players, even in terms of, just raw performance, not in terms of their contracts, differently than anybody in the public does, I feel like. And we've been saying it for years about their first baseman. The acquisition of Echevarria at the time seemed fine, but tendering him a $6 million contract is crazy pants. Brad Miller will not die. They will keep him in the lineup forever. Denard Span is definitely going to get some time in the outfield. It's a very weird thing that they do. They seem to be, I hate to come back to this, but creative in how they value players, and it just never seems to align just how we think it will, which is it's strange, and in a lot of cases it can be a good thing, but I don't get it at all. I'm with you. I just do not understand why you would keep Adeniyi Echevarria and drop Corey Dickerson, but let's move on to other garbage with the Rays.
Yeah, Odorizzi. I like this deal a lot for the Twins. They, as we mentioned before, they dealt from an area of strength. They did not deal someone who was ever going to play shortstop for them for a meaningful amount of time.
Right.
And in return, they get a athletic mid-rotation starter who has had success in the past. I mean, last season, his walk rate was way up. His home run rate was up. He still posted a 100 ERA plus. You know what I mean? Like, if he can keep runs off the board to that extent, this is a brilliant deal for them. He's made at least 25 starts each of the past four seasons. When he was at his best, he was doing the stair-stepping thing of his high fastball, low split change. You know, the problem for him has sort of been the same thing over the years, and that sometimes he gets into these foul ball battles because he can't quite put a guy away. I don't know how the Twins are going to, you know, deal with that necessarily. Maybe Josh Klock, who used to work for the Rays, now works for the Twins, thinks he has an answer. Or maybe they just say, hey, you know what? This dude is a useful starter as he is, you know, assuming his walk rate goes back down, because he's always been able to throw strikes. So assuming that goes back down, maybe the ball is unjuiced this year. Maybe having that outfield defense helps outside of the home runs. I don't know, but I think this is going to look like a very good deal for the Twins. I just hope that they go out and add one more starter. Go add Alex Cobb or Lance Lynn or whomever, Arrieta if you're a freak, and see where this team can go, because I really like this deal, and I don't have a single negative to say about the Odorizzi deal from the Twins' perspective. I think this is larceny.
Yeah, I agree completely, and I think there are five other teams, maybe 10, that should absolutely be kicking themselves knowing that they could have outbid the Rays to acquire him. You know, we talked about the Brewers as being a destination. The Baltimore Orioles just signed Chris Tillman, which is like, okay, just give up. Like, this is a horrible decision to make for any team. We'll talk about that on our next show. But, you know, there are so many teams that could have used a pitcher of Odorizzi's caliber. No, he's not a number two starter. No, he probably, you know, is going to pitch fewer innings than you would like, perhaps, out of a number three starter. But the fact that all it took was a slightly athletic shortstop prospect to pry him loose, it just boggles my mind that he couldn't have pulled more value back from a team like the Orioles or the team like the Brewers or a team like the Angels. Like, I mean, can you imagine how valuable he'd be to one of these teams that's more of a, you know, like the Twins, a near contention team, but can provide some stability to a rotation? And at $6 million, I mean, it's a steal. It's roughly, you know, it's chump change for a pitcher like Odorizzi. So I think this is a great deal for the Twins, just like you do. I think it's a bad deal for the Rays because it's like the deals that the Marlins have been making recently. It's a desperation move. If you have to make a deal like this, you are losing the deal because you're not waiting for the best opportunity. Now, this, Palacios could be a guy who's very high on internal pref lists for the Rays. Maybe they see something in him that not a lot of other people are seeing right now, but it's just tough to imagine that they couldn't have extracted more value.
Oh, I'm sure their algorithms love Palacios, but that doesn't mean much to me because, I mean, look at their track record. You know, once Friedman left, this place has been, I mean, it's sad. But, and the other thing, like you said, you know, there are so many teams, even if you say, okay, we're not going to trade with the Orioles and we're not going to trade with the Yankees because we do not want to move this guy within the division. You know, the Angels and the other teams you listed off, like that should have created enough leverage for Tampa Bay to be able to extract something better than a team's fourth or fifth best shortstop prospect. It's just mind-blowing that this is the best they could do. It has to be, like you said, some kind of owner-mandated payroll cut where maybe, you know, communication got mixed up and it went from, I don't know, maybe the slow offseason played into this too, and they were told, you know, before spring training games start, before we had to start cutting the checks, you guys got to cut this payroll, and this is, you know, what they did. But golly.
But then again, you know, why not? You know, you're the way you're cutting talent from this team, you're obviously not playing to compete in 2018. If that's the case, non-tender or, you know, opening day cut at any Echevarria, save the money there. Yeah, run Christian Arroyo out at shortstop or sign a go out and get a Ryan Flaherty or somebody to play shortstop for 2 months until you're done with your Super 2 garbage, because you're not competitive anyway this year. But hold on to the assets that could eventually bring you value in the future, as opposed to a guy like Echevarria, who is, as I kind of see it, there to play and keep your team from embarrassing itself. He's not a guy who you're going to turn around in July and perhaps trade for value. He's a guy who you have to keep the trains running on time, and you have to keep people. You literally have to field a shortstop. Run Daniel Robertson out there. Put Brad Miller back at shortstop. You're a joke already. That's not going to change things much.
Yeah. And, they picked Robertson over a guy who could very easily be useful to this team, either as a shortstop or as a platoon bat. What's his name again? The guy who went to Baltimore and had
I
like
don't
a.
I, they he was a first overall pick, and they traded him within the division and now
Oh,
look like idiots.
they traded him for a 19-year-old 6-foot-tall righty who may or may not be a reliever if he reaches the majors, so.
This is a thing where it seems like these moves are very short-term focused, which is crazy for a team like the Rays. If you know that you are going to at least consider in the 2017-2018 offseason trading Evan Longoria away, why are you trading Tim Beckham at the deadline?
It's like they got bored of having to look at Tim Beckham's name after all these years, and they're like, you know what? We need to let's mix this up. Let's just change the names here. And what was I going to say? I'm so annoyed with this, I actually forgot what. Oh, I know what I was going to say. The most, how do I put this kind? No, let's not do it kindly. Let's just say what it is. The most ridiculous part of this whole thing is these guys still have the audacity to. They're going to have the audacity to ask Ybor City to basically pay for their new ballpark. And this is the kind of bad faith management you're going to lead into these conversations with, just actively not trying and giving away players. And I mean, I had never seen Evan Longoria say much of anything negative about moves. And for him to come out and Kiermaier and Archer all to come out about these moves, that is not a fun clubhouse right now. That's not a
No.
fun camp at all. And camp, I mean, spring training hasn't even started, and the team already hates you guys and hates what you're doing.
Yeah.
This is going to be, this has the potential to be a very, very, very bad year for Tampa Bay in terms of results and other things. And I knew I was already on the under with Pecota's initial 84 win projection, but I would go under if it's 81, 82, whatever it is now, I'm still going under. This could be absolute tire fire of a mess down there.
Yeah, it's not like we've seen situations that have been this bad before, so it's not like there's no chance that the Rays will ever come out of this. In 2 or 3 years, we could be talking about the Rays again. It's like, boy, they're plucky. They got these good young players, and they're coming up, and they've got the new stadium deal, and maybe they'll start spending a little more money. And so it's not like I refuse to take such a nihilistic view that things will never be good again in Tampa, but it really looks bad from this perspective. It does not look like this is a team that's operating in the most efficient way, which, when you are forced to run a bottom five payroll, you better be working on your efficiency, and this is not efficient.
Yeah, I agree with all that.
Well, we've got, do you have enough time to walk through one more important-ish free agent signing with me?
Of course, Brian, anything for you.
All right. Well, my beloved New York Mets have brought in my beloved Jason Vargas, a guy who is a former New York Met, very, very briefly was involved in the ill-advised J.J. Putz three-way trade many, many years ago. But now they are bringing him back to the team on what I believe is a 2-year contract. I will check the exact terms right now as we speak. But it is a deal to bring in another starting pitcher, and for a team that has had so much talk about their four or five or six aces that they've had over the last couple of years, Jason Vargas is not an ace. Jason Vargas is a workhorse, left-handed starting pitcher who you plop in there and hope that he can give you 180 league average innings or something like that. But he will be guaranteed $16 million over 2 years. So, what do you think of this deal for the Mets?
I'm actually very fond of it because the reasons you noted there. Yeah, he's not You know, he's no, there's not going to be a whole lot of frills here unless you just like finesse lefties who throw good changeups. But, you know, this team needed some stability. And I know Vargas, it's kind of funny to refer to Vargas as stability when he barely pitched in the previous two seasons, but he feels safer. He feels like he should give you at least 150 plus innings. You know, the costs, it's not really a big cost. I think I would have anticipated him getting even more than he got, honestly, which I keep saying that about all of these deals, huh? It's almost like there's something going on behind the scenes, Brian.
Who knows?
That's depressing costs. I don't know. But no, I like it. I don't think you can necessarily rely on who they were relying upon on their opening day rotation already. Now you're pushing Gazelman and some of the other arms. Maybe Seth Lugo goes to the bullpen now. I don't know if that was already in the works. Rafael Montero, I know he's out of options, so he's probably in the bullpen now. So I think pushing those guys down a peg is always a smart idea. And I'm a Vargas fan, man. You know, I'm a sucker for a good changeup, and I'm even a bigger sucker for a guy who seems to really know how to pitch, and he fits both molds there. So yeah, I'm fond of this. I don't know. I can't think of a negative here other than they should have went and signed Jake Arrieta because, you know, Jake Arrieta is better. Otherwise, I think this is fine. I think it's good.
So that gets to my point. I think that in a vacuum, this is a good signing for the Mets too. I think they needed to hedge against the fact that right now, you know, you have DeGrom and you have Syndergaard, now you have Vargas. But the last two spots in that rotation are going to be made up of some combination of Matt Harvey, who is bad and injured, Zach Wheeler, who is injured and usually bad, Steven Matz, who is injured and injured. He's always injured. Seth Lugo, who is injured and probably best suited for a bullpen, and Robert Gesellman, who is injured and maybe best suited for a bullpen. So none of those options are great at this point. Matz is questionable for the start of the season. He's the best one of the bunch, I think. If you were going to write this out and script it the way I'd want it to be scripted, Matz will be good for 130 innings next year, ish, but be good when he pitches. And that's great. You can plan on that, but you need another guy. So you've got some mix of Lugo, Montero to fill in the rest of those innings, and then one of the Harvey, Wheeler, Gesellman group to do okay in the fifth spot, which I do not buy. I'm not sure that's going to happen at all. So Vargas is a necessity. This move, I think, was a pretty good move. For the cost, I think the Todd Frazier move was a very good move. For the cost, I think the Anthony Swarzak move was a pretty good move. And I have no problem with the Jay Bruce move. In you know, all of these independently, I think, are fine moves. I'm not a fan of the Jose Reyes deal. And Adrian Gonzalez, you can take or leave because I really don't know how much value it's going to bring. But it was also painfully inexpensive. I mean, it cost the team virtually nothing.
Yeah, it's league minimum, right? Because he's still being paid by the Dodgers or Braves. I don't even know if the Dodgers – whatever. The point is, yeah, they've had a fine offseason. Like, there's not a ton of impact there.
So this is the thing. When you talk about – so in the aggregate, those moves for 2018, they're going to pay Jay Bruce $11 million. They're going to pay Todd Frazier $8 million. They're going to pay Jason Vargas $8 million. They're going to pay Anthony Swarzak $5.5 million. And they're going to pay Jose Reyes $2 million. So really quickly doing the math, we're at $7.5 million, $11 million, $18.5 million. You're looking at approximately – $32-34 million that they've added to, not added to the payroll because they're actually still under payroll from previous seasons, but $32 million that they've spent for 2018 and for, you know, 2019, something like that.
Right.
How about pay Jake Arrieta a boatload of money and give him an opt out after year two? And that way you have a really high-end talent. Go out and sign Lorenzo Cain for money that is, you know, embarrassing, but is going to provide you with a impact center fielder. High-end talents. I am always in the camp that you should go out and bring in the highest-end talent that you can, and you worry about filling in the rest of the pieces later with your minor league contracts and your low-budget guys and stuff like that. I do think this team is substantially better. The combination of Bruce and Frazier and Vargas now is going to improve the floor of this team, and it's going to improve its ceiling, especially for the short term. But I would always rather you get one 4-win player than 4 1-win players or 2 2-win players.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, yeah, because I mean, you think about like you have a scarcity of roster spots and of 40-man spots and whatnot. So having that one 4-win guy is obviously preferable to 4 1-win guys. That said, I don't think the Mets were ever going to do anything like you suggested with Kane or with Arrieta or whomever. So relative to what I expected from them this winter, I will say that I actually thought their offseason was better than I anticipated. Like Frazier, if you would have told me they added Todd Frazier and brought back Jay Bruce and signed Jason Vargas and even added Swarzak and Adrian Gonzalez as insurance against Dominic Smith entering the winter, I mean, I would have been really surprised. I would have said, wow, they made that many moves.
Yep, absolutely.
So in that sense, I don't want to be too harsh, but yeah, I do agree that it's always preferable to have that one big guy. And the thing is, we talk about how they're not adding impact. It's very possible that Ahmed Rosario comes out here and has just a wonderful first full season, second go around in the majors, and it sort of gives them that internal impact that maybe we're not necessarily accounting for here. And if they get better health, if you believe Mickey Callaway's system, and there was a piece, I don't remember who wrote it now, unfortunately, but some of the changes that Callaway had made or intends to make with the pitching staff from. He's carrying over tactics from Cleveland, and one of them is like hydration. If they aren't well hydrated, they don't get to play that day, and blah, blah,
Oh,
blah.
wow.
I don't know if any of that's necessarily going to help or if it's just like false hustle or whatever, eyewash, whatever you want to call it. But maybe he does help him stay healthy or whatever. And at minimum, maybe he doesn't run his best relievers into the ground like a certain Terry Collins did. So
Right.
I don't know. I am oddly optimistic that this Mets team is not going to be a disaster, and I could see them threatening for a wild card spot. Am I being too optimistic? Do I not have the New York, the Mets, how do we want to phrase this? The Mets.
Pessimism. We always are waiting
That's
for
too
the other
kind.
shoe to drop.
No,
That it's this.
fatalism. Fatalism.
Yeah, that's true. It's the thing with being a Mets fan is you are always having your expectations built up and then disappointed. It's the we're signing Bobby Bonilla, but we're going to pay him for 30 years. We're going to have these great young pitching talents, but they're all going to get hit by a bus. Like that's the kind of thing. Like this is the type of thing that you, as a Mets fan, you start to internalize. And honestly, I am optimistic too. This is more of an argument of how I would want the team to be built versus how the front office is building this team. But it's not anything more than a two respectable opinions about how to build a team opposite of each other. Now, I'm not sure that maybe the reason that Sandy Alderson in this front office has this path to building a team because of the constraints that they're given with ownership, and they have this thing that we've talked about before where they have more of a piecemeal approach to the budget than other teams might. That might be the case, and that might be why the team does this sort of thing, but they've been doing it this way for years, more or less. But this is fine. There's not a problem with building the team through depth and trying to grow a team that's going to have, a couple of guys on short-term contracts rather than spending one giant long-term contract on a guy who, since he's going to the Mets, will probably get injured. So I get it. I understand it. I would prefer them to do things a little bit differently, but like you said, going into this offseason, I was expecting them to cut $40 million in payroll like the Marlins. And just do nothing with it. And they haven't done that. They've made the team better. So B plus for this offseason for the Mets, in my
Wow,
mind.
only a B plus. My
It's a
gosh.
B plus because you gotta any A offseason involves bringing in a player who will, dramatically change your organization. And I like Todd Frazier, but that's not it. So B plus overall. Maybe there's more to come. Like you said, maybe Ahmed Rosario turns into a 4-win player. That would be great. He's got to figure out how to lay off pitches, but sure, it's a possibility. Maybe Brandon Nimmo really is a 3-win outfielder and can just reach base 4 out of 10 times.
You can't even get through that comment without laughing. That's
Yeah, it was
how.
tough. It was tough. But
You know where he's ending up, though, don't you?
I do not. Where is he ending up?
Oh man, see, I just wanted to tie this show together nicely with a bow. So come July, when Chris Archer is traded for Brandon Nemo, and that's the entire deal, you're not going to actually hear us say any words.
Oh
It's just going to be an hour of me grunting annoyingly and Brian like
my God.
humming or
Yeah.
whatever in the world he would do if the Mets actually made a very, 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 very big, impactful and smart move. So, because oh gosh, Nimmo is he's the exact type Tampa Bay would absolutely overvalue, isn't he?
Oh my goodness, he would be the exact type of guy that the Rays would go out, they would install him in left field and say, look at this great outfield defense we've got. He's our number one hitter. He's going to get reach base on walks 15% of the time, and the Rays would go out and win 65 games.
On the next episode of the Infinite Podcast, we talk about something much, 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 much better than the Rays projected 29, excuse me, 2018 season, and
Like that, you're skipping ahead.
that is Chris Tillman's 2018 season.
Yeah, we've got some more minor moves to talk about. There's Tillman. There's a bunch of other guys who are, there's a lot of free agents still left to sign. I think there's still 80, 75 to 80 free agents that are left to sign. So we're gonna have plenty to talk about at the end of the week. We're gonna get into some of the other minor moves. Hey, maybe we'll even have a Corey Dickerson trade to talk about if the Rays, find a way to extricate themselves from this garbage decision that they've made previously, and they find a trade taker for him. But we will check it out next time. To get in contact with the show, we are DFA at baseballperspectus.com. You can find us on Twitter at DFA Podcast. You can find RJ's work at CBSSports.com MLB. RJ, you got anything that you'd like to plug?
Yeah, so it's well, you will be listening to this probably Wednesday or Thursday. I have a piece out on Jeff Mathis and catcher game calling. And it's an interesting topic, not something we can necessarily quantify at this point, at least publicly. I'm not sure if we ever will be able to quantify it, but talk to a bunch of people in and around the game, including Mathis himself, his pitching coach Mike Butcher, so on and so forth. And there's at least some interesting anecdotes in there, I think. And I don't have an answer for how much it's worth. Unfortunately, that's not something I can get into, and that's not really my area of expertise, but I talked to enough people to hopefully provide some interesting perspective on a topic that I think we can overlook. I don't think we really think of game calling because it's not something we can capture in the metrics. So when we're usually talking about catcher defense, we're talking about, blocking, framing, and throwing. So that is the latest quote unquote feature piece from me. And you can find that at cbssports.com/MLB. And, while I'm plugging things here, I obviously would recommend checking out the rest of the staff's work as well. Matt Snyder, Mike Exceza, and Dane Perry, all talented, good-hearted folks. And I mean, Dane is a wildcat, so please support that because he has raccoon in his DNA. And support the wild habits. Don't make him go drive for Uber or Lyft before he has to. That's his retirement plan for now. Support him. Let him keep writing pieces about how the Mets are going to win the 2018 World Series because his butter package told him they would. So.
Well, thanks for that plug. I'm glad we should all check out that Jeff Mathis piece and read all the rest of the work that the fine folks at CBS Sports MLB do. We'll also plug a little bit the coverage on Baseball Prospectus of all transactions. Myself and some of the other writers are covering everything that we can, trying to keep up with this flurry of moves as we start the season. So if the podcast is not enough for you, which really, why should it be? You can check us out there. RJ, thanks for joining me yet again on the show, and we will talk to you all next time.